campus of East Carolina University. Out of the west with suddenness, a nimbostratus cloud bank like a precipice obscured the sun, and a ferocious wind pulled the fine sandy soil into a corrosive blast. Then the wind ceased. Raindrops pelted the sand back into place. The temperature dropped from 80 degrees to 65. The clouds blew on toward the sea, and the low sun shone again. The whole demonstration lasted 20 minutes. That evening, I bought a hot shower in a dormitory. It cost a dollar contribution and a 30-minute I Found It bumper sticker talk intended to drive the infidel from my red heart and bring me safely under the great white bosom. Take the land, take the old ways, Christian soldiers, but please, goddammit, leave me my soul. 6. I slept deeply until a terrible clanking outside the back of the truck. I woke witless as stone, the ghost filled with hot yellow light that seemed to spin my head. Another clank and a violent jolting and shaking. I raised the rear curtain. A shrunken, sallow face just inches away stared at the rattling chains of a tow truck. I jumped out again, shoeless and pantless, the Carolina sand cool between my toes. "Don't tow it!" Behind me, a man in corporal stripes said, "You sleeping in there?" I felt as if I'd been caught in the women's dorm. The simple truth seemed inadequate. "Just resting some." "Didn't know you were inside. I'll get the citation off the windshield." "What about my rig? Could you see your way to putting it down?" "If I get a visitor's permit tomorrow." "Unhitch him, Ronnie." "Hooked up," the shrunken face said. "I see he's hooked up. Unhook him. You can hook the Chevrolet." Ronnie cursed ghost dancing back onto the sand. The corporal said, "Sorry we woken you up. We're about through bumper banging." "Thanks. I hope he makes general." Again, in bed, I wondered whether police would beset me across America. Give me the quiet lurk of wangdoodles any night. 7. Out of Greenville, on Route 32 just northeast of the road to Pinetown, gulls dropped in behind the farm walls and poked over the upturned soil for bugs, and the east wind carried in the smell of the sea. People here call the dark earth the Blacklands. Scraping, scalping bulldozers were clearing fields for tobacco and pushing the pines into big tumuli. As the trees burned, the sea wind blew smoke from the bale fires down along the highway like ground fog. Trees burned so tobacco could grow, so tobacco could burn. But where great conifers still stood, they cast 300-foot shadows through the morning, and the cool air smelled of balsam. In Plymouth, I saw a sign at a gas station, "Diesel fuel and oysters in season." A man, his eyes a camouflage of green and brown speckles, white hair to the wind, filled the tank and said, "How's this weather for ye?" "Fine today, but it's been rough." "Hard weather makes good timber. How's that Missouri weather?"
"Hard."
"Yes, sir." One word.
"That's why your Harry Truman was good timber." "Tougher than oak." "No trees out your way, is there?"
"Lots of trees, especially oaks. Red, white, burr, blackjack."
"Flat, though, ain't it?"
"Lots of hills. This is flat land."
"Whistle me, Dixie." "This county don't get up in the air no higher than a boy can throw a mud turtle, but it's God's country, and a good town. Would have been a better town, but the Yankees shot it all to hell. Union gunboats got it, sir. Hard to believe now, gunboats out in the Roanoke. Fierce river fighting. They had to make coffins out of pews from Grace Church. Buried men in their own pew. That's no joke, Dawes."
As he wrote up the credit slip, I said, "Looks like they're taking out timberlands for tobacco fields.
Governor comes out and shoots you personally if you say against tobacco in this state. I smoked 30-odd years. Did my duty and got a right to talk. Truth is, you can't buy a real true cigarette anymores. That's why they name them that way. Trying to convince you what ain't there. Real. True. Nothing to it. They cut them long, they cut them skinny, they paint them red and green and stuff them with menthol and camphor and eucalyptus. What the hell, they's making toys. I'll lay you one of them bright leaf boys up in Winston-Salem has drawn up a cigarette you got to plug in the wall. No, sir. Your timber's coming down to make toys. You don't smoke now? Why smoke what's no taste to it? Same as them light beers and whiskeys. No flavor. Americans have just got afraid to taste anything. You ask me, sir, it started with oleo. Or maybe the population got scared by them mouse experiments, whereas they give a mouse a needle shot of a substance every day until he dies of cancer. No, sir. My advice is to live for your life. That's solid advice. And harder to do than you think. Take me. I retired and ended up setting and worrying about myself, about my health. Then I bought this station to get away from myself, my own worst enemy. Don't need the money comes in. It's the people coming in I need. But I've been remarking recently people don't listen like they used to. I've noticed that. I was down the road when I realized his tumble of notions had distracted me from the oysters. There would be more. The face of the Tidewater Peninsula, lying between Albemarle Sound and the Pamlico River, showed clear now. Cypress trees cooling their giant butts in clean swamp water, black from the tannin in their roots. The road running straight and level and bounded on each side by watery barrow ditches that furnished soil to build the roadway. Ditches, road, trees, all at right angles. The swamp growth was too thick to paddle a greased canoe through, and although leafless, the dense limbs left the swamp without sun. Then precipitately the vegetable walls stopped, and the wide Alligator River estuary opened to sky and wind. Whitecaps broke out of the strange burgundy water. As I drove the long bridge over the inlet, a herring gull, a glare of feathers, put a wingtip a few feet to the left of Ghost Dancing, and wings steady, accompanied me across. Dare County, named after the first white child, says tradition, born in America, is a curious county with four times as much water as land and only two highways and four towns, a pair on the mainland and a pair on Roanoke Island. Most of mainland Dare is a spongy place, a bog that until recently discouraged developers. But now, about the county, men with caliper hands and parallelogram brains were taking the measure of the salt marsh and trying to reclaim it. A misleading word, since this tidewater has always belonged to the sea. A second long bridge crossed Croatan Sound to Roanoke Island, a low rise a little larger than Manhattan and lying just inside one of the most unusual geographic features in the country, the Outer Banks. A skinny chain of sand, the banks stretch for nearly 200 miles along the North Carolina coast. On Roanoke Island, there is no enduring symbol for the first permanent English settlement in America like the Rock at Plymouth, Massachusetts. In place of a symbol, Roanoke has mystery. Here, Virginia Dare was born, only to vanish from history without a trace 9 days later. The woods, a thick mat of shrubs and trees, looked in places as it must have when the Dares, members of Raleigh's third Roanoke expedition, came ashore. It may be that the absence of such a ready symbol as Plymouth Rock has helped keep Roanoke from the destruction of this time. The highway wound into the dark trees again as it traversed the very place where the English colonies disappeared, the last group leaving behind America's most famous mystery word, Croatoan, carved in a stockade timber. Roanoke Island gave a shadowy sense of an older time that Plymouth Rock, surrounded, dwarfed, and protected in stone and steel, has lost. A man told me, "Out on Roanoke, you can feel the beginning." 8. At the bottom of Queen Elizabeth Avenue, the main street of Manteo, North Carolina, where it comes down to the Sound, stood a Brobdingnagian statue, 10 feet of a single cypress trunk, cut into a 16th-century English courtier. A woodpecker, with uncanny accuracy, had drilled a hole in Sir Walter Raleigh's pantalooned posterior, and now there were predictable jokes in Manteo about the hole and Sir Walter's woodpecker. Manteo is the seat of Dare County, and one of the few courthouse towns, as the Carolinians call them, on an island in the Atlantic Ocean. not so remote as Key West, or so big as Newport, Rhode Island, or so famous as Nantucket, or so elitist as Edgartown on Martha's Vineyard, Manteo was a pleasant place, smaller, humbler, quieter. The docks once lining the harbor had dwindled to three, and the seashell-paved streets were now macadam, like everywhere else. The red-brick turn-of-the-century courthouse opened to the waterfront, where formerly a fleet of mail, freight, passenger, and fishing boats tied up. Now the sport fishing craft in red, blue, and yellow, each sprouting long whip antennas that gave them the look of water bugs, rocked in the little marina. Even still, Manteo looked as if it belonged with its face in the Atlantic winds. At Raleigh's immense wooden boots, a man worked quickly in the bright cold wind as he brushed preservative over the base of the statue. He was one of the town commissioners, working to refurbish the old wharf side of Manteo. Between two big oil tanks abandoned by the owners, the town had built a park reaching into the basin off Roanoke Sound. He spoke with the old London accent at the banks that some people believed to be the speech of the Elizabethans.
"We may be able to use one of the tanks in our new sewage system," he said. "If not, down they'll come. This statue is the focal point for rehabilitating Queen Elizabeth Street. New bridges did in most of the workabouts, but it's the bridges that bring out tourists now. We've got $6 million of federal funds coming here over the next 2 years. When we finish, you won't recognize Manteo."
Across the sound at Nag's Head, a new high-rise broke the flat horizon of the banks where once only small, low buildings stood. "I hope you're not going to put high-rises here, too," I said. "That's a Ramada Inn. Overwhelms everything out there. No harmony at all between it and the land. Architecture without regard for place or history. They've been Jersey Shored, if you ask me. The sea never forgets where it's been, and it's been over that land many times. We haven't had a major hurricane in nearly 20 years, whereas we used to have a hard blow every few years. New people don't know that. They come in and see open beach and figure they've found open land. But the banks aren't ordinary islands, and that's why they've been left alone. People didn't used to build much they couldn't afford to see washed away, because sooner or later most things out there get washed away. I know. I've lived there. It's always been a rough place. Land pirates, sea pirates. Blackbeard was killed down at Ocracoke, where my family comes from. One of my ancestors was on the Arabian ship that wrecked and spilled the bank's ponies that used to run wild. They don't now. Fenced in by the Park Service. They overpopulated and started cropping beach grass so close as to kill it. Pawed holes in the sand to get fresh water and caused erosion. The number one problem on the banks. People get up in arms about the fencing, but the ponies aren't natural to the island. Of course, grass isn't either, or men. Indians used to hunt the banks, but I don't think they lived there. They're barrier islands. Some of that land's moving south as much as 20 feet a year. It's a natural process, the way the sea washes sand over the islands from the coast side and drops it on the sound side. But the Corps of Engineers and Park Service have built jetties and grass dunes so sand doesn't get washed over now. They've tried to stop a natural process, and so you get erosion on the east and no build-up on the west. That's the Corps, redesigning and stabilizing nature. Today we've got bridges over land and roads ending up in the water. Then millions of dollars spent trying to pin down the banks. You talk about the Ramada. A motel at Reutzville Beach is built where an inlet used to be. They have to pump sand back in to keep the building standing. An architect has to understand our natural balance of the change that keeps things, in the long run, almost unchanged. It's not stability. It's balance. Living on the banks, you learn the difference real quick.
Sounds like somebody wants to keep something not his to keep.
90% of the U.S. coast is privately owned. It isn't easy to give up your land, even to the ocean.
9. Bucks, open 24 hours, Fish House, and Manteo, sat on pilings, its backside in the water. It smelled right, like fish. On mounds of ice lay crab slew oysters, fresh shucked or in the shell, jimmy crabs, little neck clams, chowder clams, croaker, mullet, flounder, bluefish. I got hungry, and went to the Duchess of Dare restaurant on Budley Street, a street trying to look like 16th century London. The town commissioner had said the place served a good plate of seafood. The Duchess was a tired, motherly woman in midlife, who had been in her old English Swiss chalet cooking, washing, cleaning, and figuring the books since 5:30 that morning. The ocean wind rattled the windows, and beside me at the counter the Duchess sat drinking coffee from a heavy mug. They call me Duchess now, but 30 years ago I was Doris Walker of Walker's 13-stool diner, made out of a surplus Navy bus. 13's my lucky number. Later I added a wing and seated 45, then remodeled again to get 85 in. It's successful because I worked all the time. Against one paneled wall, a preternaturally blue swordfish leapt over a formica table. The Duchess had tried to get rid of the diner image in the successive remodelings and through decorator touches like the Mexican wrought iron chandeliers, but the lunch wagon still showed in places. Above the wine rack, little boxes of Special K and Albran. Near the oil paintings of Moorish Spain, the Booster Club gumball machine. The diner, I said, the real diner of olden times is dying out, you know. 13-seat surplus Navy bus diners are rare. They're rare because you can't make a living wage off one today. She nodded toward the big circular table under the front window. See that? Around the ledge above the table were men's caps, an orange hard hat, navy blue watch cap, soiled yachting cap, a Forest Service hat. Like an all-night poker game, the composition of the table changed one at a time. Those are friends and customers. I need them, and they need my place. But it's hard to make a living off coffee. When I first opened, I was happy to sell a dozen cups a day. That won't make it now. Manteo lost most of the work boats. Today, tourists and county government keeps us alive. Tourists don't want a Navy bus. They want your olden days with all the conveniences. Me, I need volume in season to survive. If you want the real yesterday, go to Wan Chi's. They haven't seen neon light down there yet. The Duchess went back to the kitchen, and the waitress set out my platter of fried fresh fish, grilled potatoes, and slaw. Basic food, tasty without expertise, prepared by the Duchess and her daughter personally. Maybe she was right that tourists want half-timbered facades and stained plastic windows. Maybe they want an Elizabethan town, even when the real Manteo had been clabbered in shingles. Progress, retrogression. The Duchess knew best. But for me, I headed toward the town that hadn't seen neon light. 10. In 1584, Philip Amatus and Arthur Barlow, the leaders of Raleigh's first colonial exploratory expedition, returned to London from Roanoke with tobacco, potatoes, and a pair of lusty Indians to be trained as interpreters. Their names were Manteo and Wan Chi's. The Virgin Queen and the courtiers in their lace ruffs were fascinated by the red men. Months later, when the Indians returned to the Sound, Manteo, the first man baptized by the British in America, was on his way to becoming a proper English gentleman. But Wan Chi's, after seeing London, came back an enemy of civilized society. 400 years later, the towns carrying their names, sitting at almost opposite ends of the island, still show that separation. Wan Chi's, smelling of fish and a sea wind, was on the lower tip of Roanoke. For generations, the trawlers had passed through Oregon inland of the banks to tie up at the little stilt piers of Wan Chi's. They still did, although the fleet worked out of here only in winter. The boats, maybe 150 strong, came from the north, Massachusetts and Rhode Island, New York and New Jersey, to work the milder waters, where they trawled for flounder and dragged the mud for hibernating hard-shell crabs. In spring, they followed the fish north, and the summer party boats and a few yachts motored in. The town had a craft shop now, but mostly it was splintered pilings and warped gangways and fish barrels. The small houses built by seamen, used to working in limited quarters, were made even smaller by the expanse of marshweed and scrub loblolly stretching away to the sound. Rusting boilers and winches and broken hulls bobbed up like buoys from the waving grass. On lawns under the crimson violence of camellias, fishermen had set admiralty anchors rusted to fragility, or props painted red, white, and blue. From any home, the boatmen could look to the wharf and see the white wheelhouses trimmed only in black, and the booms with lines and nets dripping like kelp. The sun was just gone, the time Carolinians call day down. I walked the wharf and read names of the trawlers: Country Cousin, Brother's Pride, Blue Chip. I came to a wooden shed with two windows gleaming like cat eyes in the night. A sign above the door: James Griggs Wholesale. As I passed, a low, dusky whisper slipped from the side of the building, and a shadowy arm hooked me.
"Hey, sport, you be here to help load?"
It was a small, compact black man, without age. He fixed me with his left eye while the milky right one shone like a moonstone. Then a rasp from the shed.
"Bring him in, Balford, and let's get the hell moving."
Balford motioned for me to follow inside. He stood behind me in the doorway and said,
"Here, Griggs."
The room, a glowing of yellow bug lights and redolent with fish and diesel fuel, was stacked with crates of hard-shell crabs. The crabs clacked their bony claws and reached through the slats at my eyes. Griggs, a white man, took a good pull on a can of beer.
"Our third man ain't coming. Can you work? For money?"
Why not, I thought. I told him I could.
"You a strong boy?"
"Lift my own weight with two men helping."
"How much you weigh, Topper?"
"About 135.
"Fancy that. These here crates weighs 135. Some's a tot heavier."
So we started. The truth was, they all were a tot heavier. Balford and I slid crates to the scales. I weighed them. Balford, in a slow and uncertain hand, wrote down the number, and we hoisted them to Griggs on the truck. There were more crabs than crates, and the critters kept hopping out of the overfilled boxes like popcorn in a hot skillet. The floor crawled with their oblique scuttles for the nearest dark underside. They scrabbled and clacked, and we crunched them into an agony of yellow ooze as we heaved on the crates. I started shuffling to avoid stepping on them. Balford got mad.
"Pull on that draw hook, sport. These crabs not custard pies."
A jimmy reached up and clamped onto my pant leg and slid back and forth across the floor with me until we finished. I had to break its claw to free my cuff. The pickup, loaded beyond the legal maximum, listed to port. I asked Griggs how far he had to take them.
"Over to Bellhaven, couple hours away."
He gave Balford and me a beer, relieved himself against the shed, and fished up his wallet. His fingers fumbled among the bills and drew out a five. He said,
"There you be."
From the darkness, a man with legs like masts and arms like spars and great blue ebony lips walked up. Griggs called him Big Man. Never had I heard speech like his.
"We been out since yesterday. Got maybe 1,100 pounds of blues."
He had missed his regular truck and wanted Griggs to take his crabs. Griggs pointed to the crate stacked high on the pickup.
"Be money for me, could I haul them, but surely I can't."
Big Man said he would have to take his blues out in the sound and dump them.
"It gon' hurt me something good."
Griggs was sorry.
"See if the fish house can put them on ice."
He gave Big Man a beer. The diesel engines of Big Man's trawler mumbled at the wharf, and Griggs' crabs clacked and chattered in the crates, and the men looked for a solution. Then Big Man went off to the fish house, Griggs and Balford to Bellhaven, and I walked to my truck. Later that night, just before I fell asleep, I heard Big Man's boat pull out, and I knew he was heading for open water to dump a half-ton of blue crabs. He had said, "Most they never make it to the bottom, let the big fish eat 'em." For me, it had been one fine day. 11. I encountered Thomas Harriot, who died in 1621, the next morning, because I had on the red suspenders I wear on the road. I was finishing breakfast at the edge of Wan Chi's harbor, my legs dangling over the pier as I watched the fishermen, rubbing sleep from their eyes and squinting into the sun, move about the docks. A man sat down beside me, nodded, and unfolded a pair of glasses. On the temple was an embossed plastic label, "Near." He removed the pair he wore, "Far," and put on "Near." A person shows himself in the way he opens an orange. Some tear jaggedly with fingers, some slice with a thumbnail, some spiral, latitudinally, while others go at the longitude. That man pulled out a pocket knife and precisely quartered the skin stem to navel so the fruit came out in sections. When he finished cutting, the peel, still attached to the base, lay on the pier like an open blossom. He was not a young man.
"I used to wear braces," he said. "We all did. I'm afraid I can't remember why I put them away. And that's odd, because old men traditionally wear them. They are of surprising comfort. Would that be your reason for wearing them?"
"Part of it. When I'm traveling, I wear clothes in layers to be ready for a range of temperatures. Jacket, khaki shirt, turtleneck, and t-shirt. I have to buy pants a size bigger to get everything tucked in."
"So you peel, like our friend the onion."
"Or put on. Comfortable from about 90 degrees to 30.
"And every ounce is cotton?"
100%.
"You might guess that North Carolinians, with our heritage, are not fond of plastic fiber clothing. We believe pure cotton is the most civilized of fabrics. We and the ancient Egyptians, at least we used to before we made tobacco the crop of our hands. Now, what about the military shirt?"
"Army issue. It's a heavy twill, doesn't wrinkle much." He opened to a smile.
"Would you say this garb suits you?"
I laughed with him.
He said, "I read not long ago, I mention this because of the license on your panel truck, that there's a Missouri bank named after Jesse James. Now, is there any truth in that?"
"It's near where James lived."
"Well, then, may I say it might be the only honestly named bank in the country?"
We laughed again.
"I'm not apologetic about my lack of respect for bankers, and I'm not speaking of those out there."
He pointed toward Bodie Island Light on the Outer Banks.
"You wouldn't recall the tenant farmer system that developed after the war between the states, but it was bankers, and I speak of men, not institutions, that worked hand in glove with landowners. Sometimes they were one and the same, to keep so many Carolinians propertyless. Living in rural America without land is to be without strength."
He paused for a slice of orange.
"May I suggest how it was that Jimmy Carter rose from what some have called nowhere to the presidency?"
"You may."
"Because he showed us he came from the land, to an American land of solidity, goodness, and hope. American history is about land."
I kept my silence, and he finished the orange and with precision wiped his fingers with a tissue.
"Now I remember the sharecropper families. My father was a county agent. The sharecropper system descended from the plantation system but left behind the protective responsibility of the head of house for his workers. Farmers, black and white, became economic helots. The tenant system is indeed gone, but corporate farming comes on apace, and systems and machinery will dispossess men one step further. The hired hand will never see the boss's face, unless he goes to Hartford and reads the corporate bylaws."
He put the orange peel in his pocket.
"Must hurry. When you get as slow as I have, you spend a lot of time hurrying.
I'm late for breakfast, and my daughter expects me. She doesn't like me down on the water alone. I have no worry. Dried-out old men float like sticks. I consent to a partial cooperation for her. These are the days when parents accommodate children.
He switched to fire and rose carefully.
At times, I find I miss my nimbleness.
He straightened his coat.
Two things. Remember the land and visit Fort Raleigh. Thomas Harriot is the greatest unknown Elizabethan.
12. Fort Raleigh, the second group of settlers optimistically named it the City of Raleigh, is both more and less than it once was. The 16th-century thatched huts, outbuildings, and palisades are gone, but an amphitheater, administration building, museum, parking lot, and Elizabethan garden have come. And more trees surround the fort than four centuries ago. Win some, lose some. At the beginning of this century, the raised earthworks of the bastioned fort had washed back into the moat, leaving only humpy ground covered with live oak and yaupin holly. Restoration work began in 1950, and now the outline of the fort is clear. Because of its setting in deep woods, its age, its Croatoan mystery, and because it is the lone remnant of the first English attempt at settlement in America, Fort Raleigh is fascinating. But it is also a monument to the disease of an old world, gone tired and corrupt, trying to exploit a newer land. The whole ugly European process is here in capsule history. England, wanting to emulate Spain's financial success in pillaging the New World, but learning nothing from Spanish mistakes in dealing with Indians, and at the same time trying to circumscribe the expansion of colonial Spain out of Florida, sent a group of men, most nothing more than gentlemen pirates called privateers, to establish a colony and enrich England with marketable commodities. Many of the adventurers came infected with the European attitude toward America, expressed by a man no less than John Donne, who referred to Virginia, which then included North Carolina, as a spleen to drain ill humors of the body. The privateers did not come to build a new society, for Raleigh was no utopian like Thomas More or Roger Williams. Rather, he was merely an intelligent man who envisioned a continuation of Elizabethan mercantile society. They came as Raleigh, the leading sponsor of the Roanoke expeditions, himself said, to seek new worlds for gold, for praise, for glory. And John Smith, who built on Raleigh's failures, wrote in his General History of Virginia that there was no talk, no hope, nor work, but dig gold, wash gold, refine gold. There was, of course, no gold anywhere about. Although Edmund Spenser called Sir Walter the Shepherd of the Ocean, much of Raleigh's motivation for colonizing Roanoke Island came from the basest of motives, and the city deserved its fate. The second expedition, the one of 1585 that returned Wanchese and Manteo, was led by Raleigh's cousin, Sir Richard Grenville. Surely there were Englishmen less suited to found a colony than Grenville, but it's hard to name them. As a seaman, he was hell on the high sea. As a colonist, he was a pirate. He manifested an outlook toward the Indians, a people whose help the new colony desperately needed, that the New World hasn't yet gone entirely beyond. Never mind that Arthur Barlow earlier reported to Raleigh that the Indians were a very handsome and goodly people, and in their behavior as mannerly and civil as any of Europe. Never mind that Gran Ganameo, brother of Chief Wingina, greeted the English by making signs of joy and welcome, striking his head and his breast, and afterwards on ours, to show we were all one, smiling, and making show the best he could of all love and familiarity. Never mind that the natives greeted whites with all love and kindness, and with as much bounty after their manner they could possibly devise. Columbus, too, had carried back reports about Indian gentleness, had helped him take 1,600 Indian slaves to Spain on the second voyage. In spite of the propitious Anglo-Indian relations of Raleigh's first expedition, Grenville still saw Indians as savages and ignored their kindnesses. The Manitowocs planted crops and made fish traps for the colonists, and Indian women washed English stockings. But when a native stole a silver cup, Grenville's men burned a village and spoiled the Indians' corn. Corn the freebooting white men would need that winter. Unwilling to tend fields or catch their own fish, they began stealing from the natives. During the skirmishes that ensued for the next months, Grenville's men were not satisfied with shooting the red people. They beheaded in the old European manner. Commander Ralph Lane even launched one attack with the watchword, "Christ our victory." On and on. Whitman says, "While how little the new, after all, how much the old, old world." For these reasons, Thomas Harriot, who accompanied Grenville, is all the more remarkable. Harriot, the expedition scientist, wrote an absorbing botanical, zoological, and anthropological account of the Pamlico-Albemarle region called A Brief and True Report of the Newfound Land of Virginia. His book, containing the striking watercolors of his shipmate and Virginia Dare's grandfather, John White, is the most important historical record of pre-colonial coastal America. Ahead of his time, Harriot saw the Manitowocs as admirable people who lacked advanced civilization but not intelligence or decency. They were to him cheerful human beings void of all covetousness, a people free from all care of heaping up riches for their posterity, content with their state. Of the Manitowocs, who had no interest or need to discover a new world, he wrote, "Considering the want of such means as we have, they seem very ingenious, for although they have no such tools, nor any such crafts, sciences, and arts as we, yet in those things they do, they show an excellency of wit, whereby it may be hoped if means of good government be used, they may in short time be brought to civility, and the embracing of true religion." His idea was to enter into an exchange. Indian knowledge of the new land and its produce for European technology and true religion. Harriet's work would help the Jamestown colony succeed a generation later. Nonetheless, the failure of the new people to give comparable respect to the Indians, not just on Roanoke but over the whole continent for four centuries, would, more than any other cause, open a gulf between red men and white, a division not yet closed. 13. Because of Pamlico Sound, the largest island-enclosed salt sea on the Atlantic coast, North Carolina has more water surface than all but two other contiguous states. Sizes are deceptive here. From Cape Hatteras in the Atlantic west to Hot House, North Carolina in the Appalachians is 500 miles. Along Highway 264, skirting the sound, grew stands of loblolly and slash pine, as well as water oaks, bayberry, and laurel. Away from the open waters, the day was warm, and in Pocosins, drained by small canals and natural sloughs, mud turtles, their black shells the color of the water, crawled up to the warmth on half-submerged logs. The road passed through the fishing town of Engelhard, then down along Lake Matamuskee, drained in the 30s for farming, but once again full of water and wildlife, to Swan Quarter, around Hell Swamp to Bath. It was in Bath, the oldest town in North Carolina, that Edna Ferber went on board the James Adams Floating Palace Theater in 1925 to see a showboat performance, the only one she ever saw. I didn't want to drive the route I'd come the day before, so I headed toward the free ferry across the Pamlico River, above where it enters the Sound. 2 hours later, the ferry, with a loud reversing of props, banged into the slip. Three of us drove aboard, and we left in an uproar of engines, water, diesel exhaust, and birds. Laughing gulls materialized from the air to hang above the prop wash and shriek their maniacal laugh. Whitman thought it nearly human, as they dropped like stones from 20 feet into the cold salt scuds. Some entered beak first, some with wings a-kilter, but all followed the first to see an edible morsel, real or imagined. A boy wearing an Atlanta Braves ball cap, askew on his head, got so excited by this excellent show he almost tumbled in. I had to pull him back twice. The other side of the river was warmer, the land high and flattened, field after field. New Bern on the Neuse River was well-preserved antebellum Georgian houses. The military devastation, the repeated exchange of a town by Union and Confederate troops as the course of the war shifted, that did in so many other southern cities, did not happen to New Bern. Federal forces occupied the town early in the war and held it until the surrender. Later, as railroads developed in North Carolina, New Bern lost its importance as a port city, and progress came slower. The old ways remained longer. Most of all, the people retained an interest in the continuity of their past, and they made the new blend with the old. As a result, New Bern is an architecturally interesting city, where the Old South still shows on the streets rather than in a museum. It was afternoon. Maybe I should have stayed in New Bern, but I violated a rule of the road and drove south just because I felt I should move on. The map showed more towns, Comfort, Beulahville, Chinquapin. Either I had failed to find the towns or they were clusters of shut-up buildings. I drove on through rising fields, many given to strawberries. No longer was I in the coastal south, but coming now into the so-called deep south. The sun, glaring, began to set, and I couldn't find a place to suit me. Finally, at Wallace, I gave up. I had two towns to choose from. A long, bright stretch of hurry-up food and one-stop convenience stores on U.S. 117, or the old town of brick and stone buildings closed for the night. I parked along the railroad tracks across from the vacant depot. I'd been looking forward to a conversation in a cafe or tavern, but the cafes weren't open, and there were no taverns. It was the first of several southern evenings when I couldn't quench a thirst with anything but a sugar drink, or sit for conversation at any place other than the soft-serve stand. In a parking lot, six boys squatted about a Harley-Davidson and talked as they passed a can of beer. But for the outward trappings, they might have been Bedouins around the evening campfire. I asked one wearing a Born to Raise Hell t-shirt what there was to do on Friday night.
"Hell?" Everybody laughed. "You got yourself a choice. You can watch the electric bug light at DQ. That's one. Or you can hustle up a six-pack and cruise the strip. That's two. And three is your left hand, a boy's best friend. Maybe there's a tent revival or something like that."
"Hey, how do you revive the dead?"
I went back to my little bus, washed the strawberry fields off me, ate a sandwich of something, opened a can of beer I'd brought from the last wet county, and looked through the windshield. Cars and trucks drove by. Some were noisy, some were not. Sometimes a beer can flew out a car window. Once somebody shouted from a pickup. A dog peed on a mailbox. I wished for a corner tavern with neon and a wooden bar, but I would have settled for a concrete block beer joint. I grumbled at a hypocrisy that encouraged people to drink in the back ends of pickups. I wanted to go into the churches and hard cuss the congregations as if they were gourd seeds. 14. Had Stephen Foster not changed his mind, the P.D. River would be much better known today than it is. The first version of his famous song about southern homesickness began, "Way down upon the P.D. River, far, far away." In a morning of wrong moves, I crossed the P.D. and almost missed seeing it. Since daylight, I'd been hunting a good 3 or 4 calendar cafe. Nothing in Tomahawk or White Lake. Elizabethtown? No. I crossed the Cape Fear River, looked in Lumberton, and found nothing right. Then I overshot a turn and got pulled onto I-95. Truck diesel spouts blowing black, the throttle guts slammed past me as if I were powered by caged gerbils. Campers hauling speedboats rushed into Saturday, and so did station wagons with windows piled full of beach balls, cardboard boxes, and babies. I escaped the damnation at the Dillon exit and found South Carolina 34, a smooth road built up high out of the low wetlands. The country lay quiet again, except for the wind slipping over the roof and mixing with birdsong. The people of the P.D. Valley waved from their aluminum chairs in the back ends of pickups, and I smelled cattle rather than carbon monoxide. Driving once more instead of being driven. But I was still hungry. Then Darlington, a town of portico and pediment, iron fences, big trees, and an old courthouse square that looked as though renovated by a German buzz bomb. But on the west side of the square stood the Deluxe Cafe. the Times had left it be. The front window said air-conditioned in icy letters. Above the door was neon, and inside hung an insurance agency calendar and another for an auto parts store. Also on the walls were the Gettysburg Address, Declaration of Independence, Pledge of Allegiance, the picture of a winged Jesus ushering along two kids who belonged in a Little Rascals film, and the obligatory waterfall lithograph. The clincher. Small, white, hexagonal floor tiles. Two old men, carrying their arms folded behind, stopped to greet each other with a light, feminine touching of fingertips, a gesture showing the duration of their friendship. I went in happy. I expected a grandmother, wiping her hands on a gingham apron, to come from the kitchen. Instead, I got Brenda. Young, sullen, pink uniform, bottle caps for eyes, handling her pad the way a cop does his citation book. The menu said all breakfasts came with grits, toast, and preserves. I ordered a breakfast of two eggs over easy. Is that all you want? Doesn't it come with grits and so forth? Does if you asked for it? I want the complete whole thing, top to bottom. She snapped the pad closed. I waited. I read the rest of the menu, the Gettysburg Address, made a quick run over the Pledge of Allegiance, read about famous American women on four sugar packets, read a matchbook and the imprints on the flatware. I was counting grains of rice in the salt shaker, this was the South, when Brenda pushed her breakfast at me. The check slick with margarine and propped between slices of toast. The food was good, and the sense of the place fine, but Brenda was destined for an interstate run 'em through. Early in life, she had developed the ability to make a customer wish he'd thrown up on himself, rather than disturb her. Highway 34, out of Darlington, ran past a rummage of steel and concrete where the Rebel 500 stock car race would be held in a week. I stopped and asked a man leaning on a rake if I could look at the track. He told me how to get in. To be honest, I had little interest in an arena where men with a single talent, driving a car fast, performed. I was just looking into things. The immense asphalt oval lay baking in the quiet heat, and I walked around. When I came back out, the man at the rake said, "That your honey wagon?" "That's my truck. I expect you can stack the ladies in there like cut cordwood." He became animated, and his eyes opened and closed alternately like an old-time two-bulb blinker stoplight. He was a homely man, and the blinking didn't help. "Haven't done any stacking," I said. "Been moving along." "Traveling alone? Ever scared alone?" I shrugged. "Me, I ain't never scared," he said. "Looky here." From his left breast pocket, he took a worn bullet, a .22 long rifle. "I carried a live .45 round in the war and never got shot by friend or foe. Always carry me around over my heart. And ain't never scared because I know when I die it's a-gonna be from this, and quick. Lord'll see to that when it's my time." "You mean you'll put it in a gun and shoot yourself? It's a sin to do that, ain't it, no?" He waited for an answer. "I've heard that's the case." "Nope. This here little lady will go off by herself somewhere or t'other when it's my time. Won't know it, neither." "What if it goes off by accident before it's your time?" "You ain't a-listenin'. Ain't no accidents in the Lord's plan. When she pops off, my tickets are getting punched. Oughter get yourself one. They make a man right peaceful." The sun was like slaps on the neck. Maybe I should have talked longer to that fatalist who made sure he remained a fatalist, but I yielded to the heat. On the road again, I wondered whether there were times when he didn't put the bullet in his pocket, days he didn't feel up to the extra risk. Sooner or later, a man carries the seeds of his destruction with him, but I'd never seen a seed like that one. Dusty little clouds went puffing over powdery tobacco fields in the hot wind. The pine needles looked dry and bleached, and the buds in the deciduous trees afforded no shade. A horse stood up to its belly in a pond of rust-colored water. For me, there was nothing to do but go on into the sun. I'd forgotten to refill the water jugs and had only a few swallows of warm, stale water left from yesterday. I hoped for a soda fountain or root beer stand, but the road was dry fields and sun glare, and it went on and on. Then, like a mirage, a sign, Artesian Well. I turned around. In a cool grove of loblolly, from an upright L-shaped pipe the diameter of a saucer, flowed a silvery bash of water among ferns and moss. It gushed into my jugs, filling them instantly, almost knocking one from my grip. I drank off most of the first, gulping, spilling, drinking the coldness so long I came up gasping. I put my head under the cataract, and the force bent me over. I shook the water off. Someone was laughing. Behind me, a black man with white balls of hair at his temples said, "I had a tick hound used to do that." From the back seat of his Ford Galaxy, he and his wife unloaded 46 empty plastic milk containers. He filled each gallon, capped it, and set it on the seat his wife had covered with oilcloth. Then he opened the trunk and took out 6 5-gallon lard buckets and filled those. He finished in 10 minutes. "Do you use the water in gardening?"
"Well, he uses it in us."
They lived 3 miles away, had no running water, and came to the well Saturday mornings for 76 gallons of sweet water. "What makes it sweet?" I said.
"Nothing in that water but water. Be coming up from 400 feet, getting cleaned all the way down and all the way back up. Natural wells used to be all over here, but them new drilled wells dried up the other'n. But this one, he be too deep."
The man closed the trunk and helped his wife into the car.
"Government man came around and say he'd drill a well by the house. I told him all we'd do with it was flush a water toilet, and we got no water toilet. I says, how that water gonna get up to me? He say, with electric pump. I says, we drinks water what come up of his own mind."
When I went back for more, the water pressure shifted, answering some change in the aquifer deep below. I wondered how old the water was, how long it had taken to get down and back up. I've never drunk glacier water from snows that fell 1,000 years ago, but I couldn't imagine it being any better than the South Carolina water what come up of his own mind. Out of the pines, it was 15 degrees hotter. A car passed, the driver slumped under the steering wheel, his left shoeless and sockless foot stuck out the window. Southern Comfort. 4 words describe the history here of the last 3 centuries. Indigo, rice, cotton, tobacco. One crop yielded to another as economics, society, science, and the land changed. In the last generation alone, erosion control, crop rotation, fertilizer, and pesticide have changed the face of the South, and the people's lives showed it. Along the highway stood remnants of a reconstructed South, sharecropper cabins. Many, like the ones in North Carolina, had been deserted for a subdivision green prefab next door, but not all. On one slanting porch, a woman worked at a wringer washer, and on another, a man sat at the ready with a fly swatter. The old South disappears, yet the cabins, once an emblem of a land and a way of life, were something you couldn't see in Provo or Fort Wayne. Only on humanitarian grounds can a traveler approve the nationally standardized boxes replacing them. I crossed the Wateree River, which meets up with the Congaree to the south and forms the Santee. South Carolinians like their rivers with paired Indian vowels, the 2 PDs, big and little. The Cumbee, Kiwi, Tugaloo, Ashapu. In Kershaw County, the land began rising once more as the road went into the eastern foothills of the Appalachians. I'd come again to the Piedmont Plateau. The people call it the upcountry, and the coastal plain the lowcountry. Oak and pine covered the slopes except where sections had been logged out or a pasture opened. In the sunny flats, kudzu from last year had climbed to wrapped trees and telephone poles in dry, brown leaves. Whole buildings looked as if they had been bagged. Introduced from Japan in the 30s to help control erosion that had damaged 85% of the tillable land, kudzu has consumed entire fields, and no one has found a good way to stop it. Kudzu and water hyacinth, another Japanese import, have run through Dixie showing less restraint than Sherman. The heat held until sundown in Newbury. There, wearied from the 85 degrees, the glare, the racket of wind, I stopped. Newbury was a town of last-century buildings, old trees, columned houses with cast-iron fences, and gardens behind low brick walls. A lacy town. Old people moved along old sidewalks or pulled at greenery in old flower beds. They sat on old porches and shook the evening paper into obedience. Or they rocked steady as old pendulums and looked into the old street as if reading something there. Living out the end of an era. 15. I didn't know until 10 o'clock the next morning that Captain George Chicken, the Indian fighter, killed a buffalo in 1716 at 96, South Carolina. Not at New 1855, 96, up on Highway 34, a living town along the railroad tracks, but at Old 96, 1769, 2 miles south on Route 248, a road from the 18th century. I drove up next to a pickup under the trees. Bent over a fender, half buried in the engine well, a man tinkered and cursed. I called to him, "Is this Old 96?" He pulled himself out. He wore a National Park Service uniform. "This truck runs about as well as the government. Got a crescent wrench?" I went to my toolkit for the wrench. "Would you hop in and crank it?" The engine turned hard, then started, and I goosed it pretty good to clear it. He closed the hood. "Now, what was it you asked?" "Is this Old 96? "Almost. Actually, it's back in the woods. This is where Cambridge was. Old 96 was the courthouse town, but they moved it out here after the Revolutionary War and renamed it. Even out of college. Then the courthouse was moved 2 miles north where the railroad passed through, and they had an epidemic down here. All that killed off Cambridge. But it saved Old 96 from being built over. It's alive today because it died 100-and-some years ago. But nothing's left of Cambridge, as you see." "What about the log cabin?" "We hauled that in for a temporary visitor center. Old 96 is the newest historical site in the Park Service. Just added last year, and things are still backward. Want to see it? Haven't given a tour today." His name was something like Rocky Durham. He'd worked at Old 96 for 2 years, starting when Greenwood County still held title to the site. It was time for the morning rounds, so we went off in the government green pickup on a jolting, crashing ride through pines and brambles. I rolled up the window to keep from lacerating my eyeballs. 18 months ago, the county turned the land over to the Park Service, he said. Since then, the government's put in a parking lot, graveled the trails, and started archaeological research on the Star Fort and the old stockade town where 96 was. I don't know what I'm seeing. Just came down because I like the name. The name refers to what traders figured the mileage was from Kiowee, the old Indian village, to here, by way of the Cherokee Path. Kiowee was sort of the Cherokee's Rome. All mileages were measured from it. Traders named places along the trail to mark distances, 6 Mile Branch, 12 Mile Creek. If you like names, just up north is Gluck, and due west, and Thickety. Durham braked, opened the door, and swept in an empty beer can in one motion. People still think it's county land. They come here at night and hunt, drink, make out, even throw a party inside the Star Fort the way they've done for who knows how long. All illegal now, of course. What's the Star Fort? Durham gave the history. Indians, for hundreds of years, used a long trail that ran from the Appalachian foothills to the sea at Charleston. Hernando de Soto very likely came up the path as well as everyone else going to or leaving the upcountry. Traders, soldiers, settlers. Incensed by the Declaration of Independence, loyalists wrote a Declaration of Dependence, and clashes between patriots and Tories broke out along the trail. Just north of the stockade settlement of 96 that sat astride, literally, the Cherokee Path, patriots built a fort shaped like an 8-pointed star to control the communication of goods and messages. By 1780, the British and Tories had seized it. In the spring of 1781, General Nathaniel Greene, with 1,000 infantrymen, moved in to recapture the outpost. but Green had trouble because he lacked heavy artillery for a bombardment. Fortunately for him, so did the enemy. He tried other means to crack open the fort and stockade. First, he diverted the stream